From an early age, we're all immersed in sport. For some, it fails to ignite a spark inside us, but for those of us who catch the fire, it's the beginning of a lifelong journey filled with highs and lows, which all matter far more than they should. After all, it's just a game, we're told. Sport is a certainty, it's a point of reference in an increasingly uncertain world, and the bonds formed with either sport in general or a hometown club transcend both time and generations. Today, much of what sport has always meant to true fans has been somehow lost in a blizzard of corporate communications, fireworks, and froth. The attachments that were once so strong seem more trivial in the global age of televised sport as entertainment. What was once authentic has become increasingly staged. In this podcast, we'll get back to the things that sport has always meant to true fans. We'll take you from the boardroom, to the dressing room, to the pitch, but we'll do it not as a corporate communication, but as true fans of sport, and we'll do it with authenticity. We'll be honest, and we'll speak our minds. This is a podcast for true sports fans, and the one thing all fans have in common is a passion for the game. Now, we certainly don't mean to cause any offence, so if you find yourself taking any, just shrug it off and get back in the game, because this is about the game, and the game is bigger than all of us. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? Joining me, as always, is my friend, sidekick, mentor, hero, villain, Roger Mitchell. Roger, where are you?
I'm in Como. I must admit, Grant, I'm a little bit tired. I don't know whether it's a combination of getting up to see a certain fight in the middle of the night or...
Yeah, we're going to talk about that,
well, maybe.
Fool.
Yeah. Or maybe it's that red that we bought together in Bulgari that I've just had maybe one glass too many of as we speak.
Interesting. Now, was that La Ringhiera or was that...
No, the other one. I can't remember, to be honest. If you'd asked me half an hour ago. But the one, you know, the Bulgari guy, you know, the
red. I do remember that one.
Sotirio or something like that.
Sotirio, that's it. Sotirio.
There we go.
That's
not it. That
yes.
Drunk.
Well done. Hey, look at that.
Where are you?
I am in... A rather chilly Zurich at the moment, I have to say. I haven't really been out because I've been working, but when I did pop out, I saw a couple of brass monkeys sitting there crying, Rod. That's how cold it is out here. So I'm in some ways, I'm glad I've been stuck in my room writing all day. Anyway, enough of that. Let's get to the matter at hand, which is just you and me this week.
Yeah.
After a fantastic conversation last week. I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed having Wee Man and Jay Hee on the podcast last week.
Yeah, it was fantastic. So we've done golf, rugby and cycling recently. And I think that's enough of that. I think we should get back to the proper sport.
Well, listen, I'm just waiting for the week when we do handball, which I've got to say,
do that
the
one
most
with
ridiculous
Giles.
Game. But listen, what we need to do is we need to find a handball goalkeeper who's ever saved a shot. That's what I want to find. If you can find one of those, I say we have him on the podcast.
It's a very, very good
and
point.
Have him walk us through it at length. Anyway, you and me, that means one thing or two, if you like. Goal or own goal. And as always, my friend, I am going to do the decent thing and I'm going to let you go first. So what have you got for me?
Well, let me get this fight out of the way because it was going to be my own goal, but I've kind of lost interest in it. you know, so very, very quickly, you know, this is the centerpiece of the Matchroom, Hearn's family and DAZN boxing strategy. And, you know, they did a super undercard. And they had these two influencers who brought together a huge amount of people and audience to the fight. I stayed up. I got up to watch the fight. And again, really annoyed in boxing that they can never get the timings right. So
time did you get up? I want the full picture here. I just want to understand how completely ridiculous you are.
Well, they say things like it starts at 3 o'clock. And this is a European
time.
Come
on, you're old enough to know that does not
mean
you get up at 3
o'clock.
Right,
okay. So then I said, because I insisted with my kids, so when's the main fight? They said 5. I said, right, I'm putting it on at 5:15 because I've got experience. 5:15.
Not enough, by the sound
of things. Half six. half six European time, these two jokers come out with rap singers and some guy playing a plastic violin of the national anthem of the UK and some trailer trash blonde for him singing the Star Spangled Banner in that awful, you know, like voice exaggerated up and down runs type way, you know, the way they do it now. And just the whole thing was just awful. And fight was poor, you know. To be fair, Logan Paul looks a little bit like a boxer. KSI doesn't. But, you know, really, that's not the point. They got their whole thing going and everybody was up for it. And, you know, they did get it back, everybody excited for it. And, you know, I just wonder where it goes from here because I don't know. I just want to say this. I don't want to say too much about it, Grant, because then you tell me what you think. But I think this might be a little bit of a moment of, not just for sport, but the end of the age of the influencer. Because, you know, these kids, these two fighters, had convinced people that they had been training Rocky-esque in the mountains of Russia or whatever to get ready for a fight, that they were going to both annihilate each other and, you know, terminate and knock down the other person, and it would be the end of their career and all their followers. And it just was none of that. They weren't really in shape. Anyway, so what I'm saying is, and again, I always come back to that wonderful market research over in my house. You know, my kids said, that didn't work, you know, all this talk. And I felt like saying to them, why do you believe these influencers? You know, like, whether it's the Fyre Festival or all of this, I just think this might be zenith for the whole influencer culture, mate.
Well, here's what I think. Rog, I think you're absolutely right. And funny enough, I was sitting reading today a piece in the FT about TikTok. And as I was reading it, it occurred to me that all this stuff, all the influencers, all these new apps that are making billionaires out of people, it really is a bunch of people, some of them Gen Xers, some of them millennials, basically making money out of the millennials and youngers' gullibility or willingness to suspend belief or happiness to be duped by inauthenticity. And I thought about this conversation you and I were going to have, and it struck me as exactly the same thing. So it's strange you would bring this up today.
Yeah,
because I think this is cyclical, and I think we've had now the era of fake and how fake is fantastic, and we are going to go back to an era where authenticity rules again, and that is bad news for influencers, it's bad news for fakes, it's bad news for people who are famous for being famous. That whole thing, I suspect, is going to come crumbling down, and along with it is going to be the things like the mystique around Google advertising and how many clicks you get and how many people you reach, because, you know, I know from personal experience it's all nonsense. And actually, a good friend of the show, Dominic Henderson, our buddy out in Japan, sent me a fantastic article also today, so the stars are definitely aligning, highlighting just how fake all the search advertising is.
Yeah, yeah.
And it
That's
all
a bigger
feels like
theme,
it's coming.
Yeah,
look, it is a bigger theme, and it's not for a sports podcast, but it all feels to me like it's coming together. And we are at a moment in time where suddenly stuff like this is just ridiculed for what it is. And I'm surprised it's been coming. And again, I keep going back to this WeWork thing. But again, I think WeWork is important in so many different aspects of our culture, both business and social. You know, WeWork was nonsense from day one, but for some reason, people woke up one morning and decided to call it out for what it was, and that thing went from a $60 billion supposed valuation to zero in three weeks.
Yeah,
that's how quickly fake falls when it starts to go down. And look, in many ways, I hope you're right, Rog. I hope this is the end of fake. I hope it is the end of influencers who, you know, put sham photographs online. And I've seen a lot more of them called out recently for having obviously photoshopped themselves into you know, wonderful places to try and live these dream lives. And, you know, I think we are due a return to authentic. You know, it's one of the reasons we started this
podcast. Yes, it is.
And I think authenticity may temporarily go out of style, but it will always come back. And you know, here's hoping that that's where we are, on a cusp of a return to that.
And that's very interesting that you're saying that. I didn't expect, you know, that to be, you know, the thought process that you had. It was my sensation watching it. And, you know, I think, you know, you saw the Man City thing they got into with the influencer policy, that they had to sack the agency. I just feel, you know, you and I have been round the block a few times, Grant, and you can sense when the wind changes, and this has got knock-on effects for sport. You know, Matchroom DAZN, as I say, have put a whole lot behind this fight, dragging forward their whole boxing strategy. And anyway, I think this is going to be a kind of tipping point, and we do believe in authenticity. And these two guys, I think they were going for it, you know. But honestly, they weren't boxers, you know. And certainly KSI, the British guy, is nothing like a boxer. And it was quite sad that they were coming on after, you know, world championship fights. That the triumph of fake over authenticity, and maybe today is the day that it all changes.
Well, look, I've never understood. You've explained this to me many times, and you've been spot on in explaining strategies and stuff going forward. The thing I could never understand, and I'm sure it's an age thing, and it is my absolute revulsion over anything inauthentic. I could never get sucked into that. I mean, the chance of me getting up for a KSI and Logan fight, even if my bed was on fire, are fairly small, to be honest with you. But But watching that now and watching it go back the other way, I marvel at the fact that the people are upending their entire strategies to cater to a generation whose attention span is so short. You know, that thing you said about your son saying, "Oh, this is a dead meme now."
Yeah,
the shelf life is zero for this stuff, and so. Yeah. If you are going to chase the latest thing and try and build a strategy around it, I think there's going to be two or three of those, and you're suddenly going to realize, you know what? We have to stick to what's real, what's pure, what's authentic. And you wait for the fads to disappear, and you wait for them to come back. Because, look, people are always going to come back to what's real. Societal trends change, fashion trends change. But they're just that. They're trends, they change, and you have to come back to reality, Rog, ultimately, and reality is authenticity. It's pure.
Yeah, the thing that surprised me, I was watching it with my son, who was elsewhere. He's down in Liguria, but we were texting at that time in the morning, and you know, I you wouldn't have seen it, but there was this knockdown that happened, and it was a fair knockdown. It was a decent punch. And KSI was on the ground, and his legs had gone. And the referee gave him best part of 3 or 4 minutes in the corner to compose himself again, under the pretenses that it being a foul punch, which I don't think it was. So, you know, I was texting to my son saying, look, you know, what these guys are wanting is that this isn't a clean-cut decision like a knockout, so that they can maybe continue with this farce,
yeah.
You know? And he said, you think? I said, well, I think, yeah, like I told you, the first fight would be a draw. I think this one now is going to be a very close decision. They're docking him 2 points for this, what they're calling a rabbit punch. So this will be a close call, and they'll probably go at it again. And afterwards, you know, they came out afterwards with the usual, you know, I respect you, you're a great fighter, don't believe all the shit talk, because, you know, it's all part of the game. And, you know, I saw him saying, well, God, they don't even hate each other. And I said, yeah, that's called marketing, you know? And like, it was like, I thought, geez, you know, it goes so quickly when the curtains are pulled aside, you know, how quickly the whole world of influencers and real, because their whole thing was this, that one of these two were going to lose, and they were going to lose all their followers. Their career would be over, because they would never dare to darken the world of social media and internet again, because they would be flamed and the abuse and everything like that.
Oh, dear God.
And the reason they say that is because KSI's first opponent, a similar type influencer, I think a chap called Joe Mercer, I may be wrong on that. He lost.
I hope you are. Otherwise, you know way too much about this crap.
Yeah, and his career as a kind of like social media personality ended after he was beaten by KSI. And this was the whole thing. Which one of them is going to have their career truncated at the age of 20-something? And I think they just realised, a lot of kids last night, that that's not what this was all about. It was just the Benjamins, as usual, you know?
Well, look, I mean, unfortunately, if the strategy is that someone who, by definition of being where they are, is utterly shameless, is going to end their career because all it would take for them to end their career is the shame of them deciding they couldn't face the public again. Give it up. I mean, they will reinvent themselves in some other way, right? I mean, that's what this is all about. This is all about being in front of an audience and doing whatever you feel that audience wants you to do in order for you to be famous. I mean, it's a symptom of the incredibly inauthentic world in which we live, Rog. And for me personally, I can't wait until they all curl up and disappear and people like your kids realize that they are just being marketed to, they are being taken advantage of, they are being fleeced out of their hard-earned or hard-begged from their parents' money for nothing of any substance whatsoever.
Well, so this is what I said to him. I said, because we were up early, remember? So we saw the undercard, which was, by the way, a world title fight. It's just laughable. A world title fight. And I said, so tell me, so they've brought you in here. By coincidence, you've seen the bout before, which is a world title fight. Has this made you any more interested in boxing? Response, I don't know anything about these guys. There was no knockouts, so no.
Yeah.
And I thought, right, okay. The point I'm making here is, whether it's influence or not, Grant, there is a dramatic need, and I keep coming back to this in sport, to work really hard on the backstories, on the personalities. You know,
Roger, that I don't disagree with. I mean, look, I loved boxing in the 80s, but and the 70s, because I knew everything about the boxers.
Yeah.
And that was because you weren't deluged. It was much easier to keep up with Hagler, Hearns and Leonard and Duran, and they fought frequently, and it was always, you know, it was a big thing to watch it, and you knew the backstories. And the heavyweight division, the same. Now, you know, we've had, after Tyson and Lewis, we've had a procession of boxers. I don't think you know who the heavyweight champion of the world is. And so they do get lost. So I totally understand that part of it from your son's perspective, that knowing the backstory and having some kind of connection to the boxers is important. But I think understanding that these are real guys fighting real fights will ultimately matter to these guys. And this fake nonsense will go away. I agree.
So listen, let's go on to your goal and come back to the uplifting stuff, and we'll come back to my goal later.
All right,
you go first.
My goal is unequivocally the Lionesses, and I'm sure you're going to understand what I'm talking about. You know, we've talked about the Women's World Cup in the summer. We had an extraordinary young woman on last week in the podcast, in the shape of Jay. And this idea that women's sport is building real momentum was solidified a couple of days ago when the Lionesses, the England women's team, played at Wembley Stadium to 80,000 people. An extraordinary crowd, by far the biggest they've had. They had a parade before the game of all the, you know, the I don't want to use the word old, let's call it ex English women internationals who, you know, were finally getting the recognition they deserved. It was a good game, and to top it all, in a very poetic ending, the English women's football team were welcomed onto parity with the men by being beaten by West Germany, or
on
by
penalties,
Germany rather.
And penalties.
So it had everything. It had absolutely everything. But I think for me, that's a real turning point for the women's game. And we can only praise that. You want to talk about authenticity? This is authentic. This is great athletes doing remarkable things for their game, for their gender, for young people all around the country. In this case, I just thought it was a fabulous event.
Yeah, no argument from me. You know, from the summer onwards, I've been saying pretty much the same stuff there. Also about the fact that the game that they play, compare it to the game that we've just seen this evening, Liverpool and Man City, is a slower game. It's less physical, which means that there's more time to show their talents, and they've got plenty of talents, these girls. I'm just curious to see where it goes from here, Grant, because it's not a slam dunk. Yeah, it's got a lot of people just now getting in, and but it still needs to, I think, make a big, big leap to be a mainstream sports rights holder, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, but I don't disagree with that. But you tend to do that. You tend to look at it as a rights holding exercise. For me, it's. I think that time will come. I think they're now on a road where that time will come. Particularly as when you start getting 80,000 sellouts, the advertisers will come, the equipment manufacturers will come, and they will make stars out of some of these amazing young women, and that's kind of how the snowball starts. But at least behind them, there's some substance. There is, you know, some years of hard work and training, and you know, there's nothing inauthentic about any of these girls.
No, no. So still on football, I'm going to stay on football now all night. Still on football, my goal is the game that I've just seen a couple of hours ago, that Liverpool Man City game.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you caught it. I know you're working.
Well, kind of in the background, but yeah.
You know, there's a bit of a theme that, you know, English football sometimes is more marketing over reality. You know, when you get the Huddersfields versus Burnleys and you say, well, really, is this premium product? Tonight, there was no doubt that this is the top of the top of the top. I just, you know, I can be very cynical about a lot of things in football, but I just saw wonderful players giving full commitment, great talent, great tactics, teamwork, obviously coached by the two top guys. And in terms of my sport, I was just riveted for 90 minutes, and that hasn't happened for a long time. So I think that I just want to say, I've got another couple of things to say about football in general, but you know, in the first instance, I think I'd like to celebrate that in Liverpool tonight, there was one hell of a game of authentic sport.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, it was everything you could want, right? I mean, it was the two best teams in the country going at it. It was a lot closer than that 3-1 scoreline suggests.
You think?
I thought Liverpool deserved to win, but I think, you know, a couple of decisions here and there, and it certainly wasn't going to end up 3-1. I think it was the right result. I think there was, you know, good respect from the players and even the managers at the end, who, if you believe the press, don't like each other, but there was, you know, they shook hands, had a word with each other, and you know, even Klopp, when he was being followed by the cameras off the pitch, you know, wasn't going to get baited into, you know, taunting the Man City guys by getting the crowd all going. I thought it was, as you said, a fantastic advert for a fantastic game. And you know, they are the two top teams, but you've got the added bonus of, you know, Lampard's Chelsea, and you've got Leicester. I mean, this is shaping up to be a fantastic season for football purists. There's no ways about it.
Well, that's true. That's very true. And what I would want to say, though, is a little bit something that I ran into last week when I was with our old friend, Matteo Campodonico of Y Scout. I was down in his part of the world and we were talking about the future of football. Because obviously, as we heard on the podcast, he's a huge visionary. And, you know, he was basically saying something in a very, like, cold, unemotional way, something that I get into a lot of hot water about sometimes when I say that the game is polarizing into Hollywood clubs and into what I call local community art house clubs. And tonight we saw two Hollywood clubs. And he said something and then told me about some of the things he's doing just now that really got me thinking more and more. He said, apart from the ones that want to win something, and that's the usual dozen, 18, 20 clubs, European clubs that want to win something, big things, he said, every other club is now being run as a trading platform. I said, yeah, you mean player trading? He said, yeah. He said, the data now is such that anybody smart can choose their manager, set out their playing formation and strategy, and choose their players very clearly based on certain KPIs and data that will maximize potential upside. In our world of portfolio management, Grant, it's basically saying you can do it with a football club now. Now, I don't want to go into that because we haven't got time tonight about how that works and X goals and everything like that. And but how do you feel, you know, talking about authenticity and everything like that, where he's saying that your club, maybe my club, most of the clubs in Europe are being looked at by their owners, either their current owners or their soon-to-be owners, as trading platforms where algo trading, because I'm going to make that a metaphor even more, algo trading along the lines of the data that's coming out of systems like Y-Scout is being used to select players, put teams together, and decide when you move players on.
Honestly, for me, I don't think it makes a shred of difference, Rog, because the authenticity in football at that level comes from the connection that the fans have to the team. Now, do you weaken that potentially? I guess possibly. But the chance of moving fan favourites on is small, because generally if players aren't playing well, they fall out of favour with the fans fairly quickly. So, you know, for me, that it's that connection with the team that's in the fans' blood. If the team are playing badly, they're going to get on their case. If the team are playing well, they're going to lap up every minute of it and enjoy it. But I don't think that the players necessarily dictate that relationship, because you know I've been a Fulham fan for I don't know, it feels about 174 years, and you know the players have come and gone. We've had bad teams, we've had good teams, we've celebrated, we've commiserated, and I don't think there's anything more than a couple of times they would sell a player and you think, oh, why did they sell him? But they got the money for him. I think maybe at the top level it might make a difference. But at that point, they have the money. They can buy and sell the best players in the world. So I don't think that's going to matter, Roger. I really don't.
I think that's quite optimistic. You know,
How do you think it will manifest in a way that is going to matter to the fans?
Well, the way that I've looked at these strategies, and I've actually seen, you know, a couple of other startups who are playing the same kind of like algo player trading game based on rich data. These startups are out there now, and the maths and the data is out there now. I'm not sure when it's very clear that the person running your company has got a buy low, sell high strategy, which means by definition, mate, that you're selling your player, not when he's fallen out of favour with the fans, but when he's at the top of his popularity at the club.
But Roger, for the small clubs, it's always been like that. You sell them when you can get a good price for them. You have to, right? I mean, it's only going to affect a few clubs, I think. I mean, it's someone like Fulham, if they ever have good players come through, as a fan, you know you're going to lose them. And you know that they're going to go before their peak, because that's what the Fulhams of the world are there for. And you kind of hope you get a little bit longer at them. You know, Ryan Sessegnon is the perfect example. You know, a quality young player. You know, Fulham's player of the year at 18, the best player in the championship in our promotion year at the age of 18. We got one more year out of him. I was convinced he was going to go as soon as we got in the premiership. He was off, but we got one more year out of him. You know, he didn't play great because I'm sure he had one eye on a big contract and didn't want to get injured. But then he went to Spurs. He can't get in the Spurs team, but he'll thrive there and he'll get better. But it was no surprise to me whatsoever. I don't think anything is going to change for the small clubs, maybe for the big clubs, but they won't be forced to sell.
Okay. Well, you know, let's see how this develops. I tend to think that most fans, and indeed the industry in general, doesn't realise what's going on under the bonnet here in terms of polarisation. As I say, there's a group of clubs that are, quotes, will be looking to win things, and every other club will be run as some kind of sophisticated, data-led player trading platform.
Yeah, I don't disagree with it, but I think, and I, look, you you have the luxury of being a Celtic fan, so you're used to actually winning things. Yeah, you know, I'm a Fulham fan. I'm not used to it. But you know, as a Fulham fan, you know, I remember the day we won away at Old Trafford in the Premier League. You know, I remember that. It was a huge day. It was fantastic to win at Man United. You know, I remember going to Hamburg with my dad and my brother to watch the Europa League final. I remember our promotion year under Kevin Keegan. Yeah, you remember those things. It doesn't take away the fact they don't happen often. And some people would say it actually amplifies them because you don't expect to win. It's just a nice experience to go through. So I don't know. I don't know that. I think you're probably right. People won't understand what's going on under the hood. But I think for the most part, it won't matter because the victories will still be the victories. The players will come and go. The reasoning behind it is normally lost on people anyway. So I don't know. I don't think it's a big deal, to be honest.
Okay. But, and it's one to watch, honestly.
For sure.
It's like our world in finance. Algo trading is coming to football, mate.
Well, I guess that's inevitable, right? I mean, Billy Beane, I guess,
that's
sorted
it.
That. And
yeah.
they're just automating Billy Beane.
Yeah. So what's your own goal this week?
Well, my own goal is it's a bit tongue in cheek, and it's a shout out to our, a friend of the show, Eddie Pepperell, who is playing in the Turkish Airlines Open, or rather was until he got disqualified.
What?
And he got disqualified, and I was looking to find out as to why he got disqualified. I couldn't find anything on the internet. I was just checking his score off as they were playing the third round. Couldn't find the score, so. Eventually, I found at the bottom of the leaderboard, Eddie Pepperell DQ. So I texted him and said, DQ, did you go to Dairy Queen or did you get disqualified? And he said that he'd run out of balls. It turns out what happened, he'd had a tin cup moment and hit four balls into the same lake on the fourth hole trying to get over it. Then realized that he had no more balls in his bag, couldn't finish the hole and was disqualified. So... he took it very well, if our text conversation was anything to go by. But that's my home goal of the week. Running out of golf balls on the fourth hole for one Mr. E. Pepperell. Eddie, if you're listening to this, God bless you.
Well, you say if he's listening to this, well, maybe I'll slightly change the tack of what I was going to say now. Seriously, right? See, when we had him on the podcast... Well, there's one phrase that stuck in my mind, and I know you're a big fan of his. He said, the biggest danger for me is apathy.
Yep.
I think he's proving it every single day. I must admit, he's a lovely guy. I don't think he's got that burning desire to be where his talent could take him.
Well, look, you may be right, Rog. You may be right. See, for me, I look at it the other way, in that it's a game that is almost ridiculous if you think about what golf is, right? And if you think about the money that's thrown around for these guys. And for me, I think if for any reason you're not feeling it one week, or you just kind of, I think you know when you're on and when you're not on. And so I would argue the other side of the coin, saying, why beat yourself up and get in your head if you can be honest and say, you know, I know this week I just don't have it. I take your point, and I'm sure the press in the following days are going to be filled with, oh, is it disrespectful to the game, you know, to do that and not finish the hole and walk off. But I think you have to do what's best for yourself and best for your own character and best for your own psyche. And, you know, as I've gotten to know Eddie, I admire the fact that he doesn't let this stuff faze him. And when he has a bad round and he is in contention, he doesn't let it faze him. He's the same when he's had, you know, when he's had a bad round when he was in contention, and he's the same here for me. So I totally get what you're saying. And look, we'll get him back on the podcast and we'll ask him. And I'm sure he'll be as open with us about this as he was all the other things we asked him about. I'll take the other side that he doesn't have what it takes for his talent's sake and Maria's. I think he's young, and I think he's learning, and I think he's immensely talented. More importantly, I think he's got a very good head on his shoulders, even though that what happened this week at the Turkish Open might belie that. I would argue.
No, no, he's got a great head. I mean, he's a philosopher. He's a thinker. He puts everything into perspective. But what I'm saying is, an elite sport, you not almost have to be a maniac. I mean, we got a little taste of that from Jihei last week. You know, where you could basically understand that. You know, she's close to being a club thrower when she was like, you know, on the tour.
Oh, Eddie's thrown his fair share of clubs. I've had this conversation with him. There's no doubt about that.
Well, it's not the image he's putting across. He's got this whole chocolate thing going on and he's joking. I would really like to read a story that he does that and he goes up and smashes a fucking hotel room up, Grant. You know, seriously. I mean, like, I think that's...
But Rog, that's you. That's why you want to hear it, because that's what you do.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's... I get it. But he and I had a very amusing conversation about some of the clubs he's thrown in the past. He's not going to do that. I think he's got it in perspective. I think he understands where the game fits in his life. I've got nothing but respect for the way he handles himself. I think some people don't need to be that pit bull to get the best out of themselves. And others do. And I think you can only really do what's the best for you and your character. Sure. But look, we'll get him back on.
That's a great own goal. Yeah, we'd love to do that.
It'd be a great conversation to have with him.
It would. Yeah, that's a great own goal. I hadn't read that. That's fantastic. Listen, I'm going to end with own goals again all around football. I'll give you two or three to choose from. The first one I'd like your view on. As you know, I'm quite close to Inter Milan. I did a lot of work there when they were taken over by the chap Tohir, and they've now been taken over by Suning, who I've got some good contacts with. And
I thought you're only supposed to call them Inter.
Internazionale di Milano is the real name, Inter Milan.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, whatever.
I thought the two teams were Inter and Milan, and you didn't refer to them as anything else. That was my understanding.
No. Internazionale di Milano is Inter Milan, and Milan is only Milan. They don't have anything at all. AC is Athletic Club, but it's like FC. So, and they're named in English. That's why they're pronounced in an English way, Milan, because they were founded by English people. Anyway, that's digressing.
We've had this conversation. Whose strip did they use? That was Juventus.
Juventus,
Notts
County.
Strip,
but
right, yeah.
Most of the Italian clubs were founded in some shape or form by English folk. Genoa, Inter, Milan.
Anyway, I've got you off the subject. Sorry,
because I don't want to give away people who say things, but I've got a lot of sources in different areas in Inter Milan. And they have had a terrible few years of it, as you know. And last year they decided to bring in Antonio Conte, who you'll remember from Chelsea. And all that. Now, Antonio Conte is many things, and he's certainly a winner, an undisputed winner. Coming back to Eddie Pepperell, one of those maniacal winners. You know, like you don't want to be losing in his dressing room. It's not a nice place. So Inter Milan saying, look, we've sucked for years now. We need to bring a winner in. Conte's available. Let's go for him. And the chat around the time was, but you win, but you know he's unmanageable. You know that he will always insist on extra players, extra money. He will not toe the party line. He will not come out with the right PR line that protects the ownership and protects them from fans and everything like that. And I remember at the time they appointed him, there was a whole lot of debate about, do we go for him or not? And as always with Antonio Conte, he comes in and he's top of the league. As we sit here just now, Juventus have got a game in hand and they're playing as we speak. Inter are top of the league, which is an astonishing turnaround. He has done a magnificent job. In Europe last week and also against Barcelona, his team in games that they were winning ran out of juice. And on both occasions, but especially last Wednesday, he came out and blamed his board, where he said, what do they expect? You know, if they don't give me the squad, the depth of squad, then what do they expect me to do? And, you know, he did this with Juventus as well, the famous phrase, You can't expect to eat in a restaurant of 100 euros a head with 10 euros in your pocket. This is Conte. And some of the people that had this debate last summer very pointedly, you know, texted me saying, is this not outrageous? And, you know, on ESPN, you know, somebody, Marchiotti, that really good journalist, he was saying that Conte needs to realise that we don't live in the 90s anymore, where you just moaned to an owner, and you had one of these owners at Fulham as well, who just opened the chequebook because football's changed.
Really? Well, I think he might have smashed open a piggy bank. I don't think he had a chequebook to open.
Al Fayed, did he not have a lot of money? I mean, he got you to the UEFA Cup final. Come on.
I think he let the players go for a supermarket trolley dash.
Whatever. Anyway, the times have changed. Moratti used to be the president of Inter Milan, and he would always do that whenever the manager moaned. He would buy them Ronaldo or Bobo Vieri or something like that. So the point is this, and I'd like your view on this. Do clubs in 2020 pick somebody that will give them an impact like Antonio Conte, knowing that he will be hell on earth to manage as you're trying to run a sustainable club over a medium-term strategy?
Well, look, it depends what you want, right? I mean, again, Inter expect success. The fans expect success, and they expect it from the board, right? Because the managers come and go, but they put that success onto the board to hire the right manager, to buy the right players. And I think if you want to compete at the very top level, if you want to win the Italian league, you want to win the Champions League, you can't do it just with a good manager. You have to spend the money, Rog, these days. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, but there's financial fair play, Grant. I mean, like, well, it's not like the old days. This is my point. And he doesn't seem to, like, want to play that game.
Well, but is he saying they've run up against the limits and they're stymied and he's got terrible players he needs to clean out?
No.
Or is he saying you haven't spent the money?
Yeah.
We've got... Well, so, I mean, is he wrong, Rog? If they've got money under, let's call it the salary cap, for that's what it is in a sense. Has he got money under the salary cap that they're not spending?
I think they're pretty tight on that. They've just come out from the UEFA sanctions of being on the kind of like naughty step on financial fair play. So they've just kind of cleaned up the mess of previous years.
Right.
He wanted Lukaku, he got that. He wanted other players out that he didn't like and basically meant that they couldn't get any real value for them and fire sale prices like Icardi, like Perisic, people like that. So he's already come in and said, this is the way it must be, in a very spoiled child type of way. And then he runs against, you know, the Champions League. He can't bring home the results, which is fine. But rather than saying, well, you know, we've made progress, look how much different we are from last year, I'm very pleased, who would have thought 2 years ago we'd be toe-to-toe with Barcelona and Dortmund? That's the thing you would expect your manager to say in modern football, Grant. What does he say? They've let me down. Look where they were last year. I've come in, I've done the business domestically, but they're not helping me out. I think that's outrageous.
But you're arguing against yourself here.
Possibly.
This is double standards. Because, you know, on the one hand, we're talking about Eddie Pepperell. You said, oh, I need this guy to want to win, and apathy. Conte's come out expecting to win, expecting the very best.
He knows financial fair play. He's just deflecting a defeat against his board when he knows his board don't have a lot of room for manoeuvre. They've already pushed the boat out for him. That's my point. He knows All right,
I don't know if I'm with you on this. If he's winning, he's going to have the fans behind him, and that's going to get his back up, because he's going to know that the fans are going to take his side against the board. I'm sure that the conversations they have in private, away from the TV cameras, are wholly different. And I'm sure he'll sit down with them and say, here's what I want. And they'll say, well, look, you can't have it because we can't spend that money. And I'm sure once he knows that he's hamstrung by the FFP rules, then the conversation ends. But is it going to stop him
being
emotional,
like that,
and saying exactly what's on his mind? No, I don't think it is.
Anyway.
Would you want him to? Would you want him to change his character?
I want him to be a team player. I want him to be a team player, to work out at the start of the year saying, I can get you Lukaku, I can get you the other ones, but realise that that means we can't do much more for you until next summer.
And all right, so let me ask you this. Let me turn it around and ask you a question. Knowing this is him and what he's like, would you have hired him as your manager?
That was my question to you. And you know what? Yes.
Exactly. And that would have been my answer too.
Fuck it. I mean, like, seriously, they're top of the league. And
right.
But yeah, it's on. This is the reason I brought it up as my own goal. It's the classic unmanageable situation in football. And I'm going to throw you a couple of other ones that you can decide whether that's the own goal or very quickly these are, and these are very brief. UEFA taking the Champions League final to America in 2024. New York is mooted. Liverpool.
I'm okay with that.
You're okay with that. You're all right with that?
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
The fans having to get these kind of tickets to go to America.
Well, let's see. I mean, if someone from... If Zenit St. Petersburg get in the final, then it'll be tough. But I think if any of the big clubs, I think they would love a big final in New York, or, you know, I think that would be... These days, Europe to New York is not such a big, long trek anymore. And I suspect that the fans, rather than having it in Baku, which was ridiculous, having it in New York, I think will be great for the game, and I think the fans will absolutely love it.
All right, so that's not an on-goal. What about Liverpool playing two entirely different teams in the space of 2 days in the Carabao Cup and in the...
Yeah, that's a good one. I think that's a very creative solution to a problem that they should never have been faced with. How's that? You know, I don't think anybody can realistically look at them and castigate them for what they're doing. It's very, very hard to do that, particularly as they've played that team in a thrilling game against Arsenal and won with them. So how do you... Yeah, how do you have a go at them when they do that?
All right, okay, so you're okay with that one as well.
But what about you? Where do you stand on that one?
Where do I stand on that one? You know, I always come down to the industry bit of it. I think poor sponsor. You know, like, you've decided to put your money behind the League Cup, which is now called the Carabao Cup.
And why are you having two-legged semi-finals?
All of this is true. All the fixture nonsense, you could pick holes in it all over the place, but it's not easy. Fixturing isn't easy. But what I'm saying is, somebody has sat down with this energy drink and said, you know what, the League Cup's a good property for you to get your brand values behind. It's a wonderful kind of like a match with exactly your objectives. It's clear that no team gives a shit about the League Cup compared to anything else.
Bro, they didn't give a shit about the Rumbelows Cup or the Milk Cup.
So why sponsor it? You know, this is...
That's very simple, Roch. That is the cheapest way of getting your product associated with Premier League football clubs. Pure and simple.
Well,
and the exposure you think that gives you.
Well, there you go. Exposure. I think sponsorship's moved away from that. I think it really is much more about whether you're getting associated with the right kind of mood music and vibe. And, you know, teams playing their second string and maybe threatening not to play at all and your name's on top of it. I kind of think it's saying you're a second-rate drink or a second-rate product, because that's a second-rate competition. Do you follow my reasoning there?
I absolutely do. But let's be honest, it's been that for... two or three decades.
Never as bad as this.
When was the last time the League Cup mattered, really, realistically? It was a long time. I mean, it did matter once, but it was a long time ago. And I think if I was Carabao, who, frankly, I'd never heard of until they sponsored the League Cup and didn't know who or what they were for two or three seasons because I couldn't be bothered to look it up. because the competition is a second-rate competition.
There you go.
But for me, if I'm Carabao and I can have headlines about United versus Liverpool in the semi-final of the Carabao Cup, it's worth it for me.
All right.
Because I am with Manchester United and Liverpool and Arsenal. I can't afford to get my name associated with them any other way.
All right. That's your view on that one. My last one is potentially banning heading in football.
Don't even get me started on that.
There you go.
Seriously,
like, is that an own goal or not?
That is 3 own goals. That is ridiculous. Seriously, if we reach that point, that I'll stop watching.
Right, okay.
I suspect every other fan will.
Well, let me take the other side of that trade. We've had a great many high profile older players from the generation of wet, heavy balls who have suffered dementia. And we mentioned one last season, Billy McNeil is one of those. Chris Sutton, his father. There's a lot of them. And I think we've only seen the start of this problem. Now, I tend to agree with you, not in the kind of like, you know, way that you know, you've come at it. I tend to agree with you because I think I can probably get comfortable with the fact that as the balls have got lighter.
Much lighter.
Yeah, then it's probably much, much less a risk. But I think it's wrong for football to say, well, you know, if you take heading away. It has been an issue, Grant. And like all things, I think we need to, like in cricket, get new protection and put a helmet on. I think football should just be a wee bit careful with this.
What do you think? They should play with helmets on?
No, I think they should show respect for what's happened. Be suitable.
Oh, look, for sure. I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying, you know, today's footballs, Rog, I mean, come on. When you said it, in the days of big, wet, heavy balls, which is not a phrase I ever thought I'd say out loud, particularly being recorded, but it was wholly different. I mean, I grew up playing with those things in the head, and it was agony. But today, I just don't see that they're in a completely different league.
All right, okay. So
if you show me evidence.
There is evidence.
And studies
the report came out.
What have you?
The report came out.
Okay, and what does it say?
It says that there's a causal effect, and that the PFA, as a union for players, were maybe grossly negligent in not dealing with this earlier.
And how are they supposed to deal with it?
Well, I don't know. I've got some contacts with clubs. A couple of them have come to me and said, "Do you think we're exposed for potential damages cases from older players?" There's some talk around this that, you know, a little bit like, you know, the whole concussion thing in the NFL that,
yep.
And everybody's burying it and saying, oh, it'll never be anything. I think we just got to be a wee bit careful because none of us want to ban heading, but this needs to be dealt with in the appropriate way or it could get out of hand, I think.
Yeah, look, of course it has to be dealt with in the appropriate way. But again, how can you be liable for things that you didn't know were a problem, right? I mean, that's the base case. Now, you can argue around that, but that's my starting point.
I don't know, Grant, I don't want to be flippant, but I mean, is that not the whole asbestos industry? Is that not the whole same thing?
Well, look, when it was first invented, asbestos was the greatest thing in the world.
There
Rog.
You go.
I mean, so, no, but they didn't, it was only later, once they did the studies, that they realized, and then they banned it. That's fine. But it's very, look, this is, our culture now is a blame culture, right? And everything people can find to go back in time and say, well, you know what, you shouldn't have done this. To me, the answer is, well, if I'd known then what I know now, I probably wouldn't have done it. But you don't have the luxury of that argument, which I think is unfair. Now, should the clubs who have plenty of money offer medical cover for these guys? Absolutely should, yes. That's the right way to handle
okay.
it. But I think forcing it through, you know, they should be volunteering to do that rather than being dragged, kicking and screaming to do it because it's the right thing to do.
No, I think that's where my position would be. I'd get ahead of this and I would do something exactly like that.
Well, it was, you know, Roger, it's nice to end a week, you and I, in agreement.
Well, we have got one further thing to do, which is the Chris Cairns smart sport question, which is a beauty. Given that we spent, when you and I were last together, a whole lot of talk about fit and proper rules and realpolitik and governing bodies closing an eye to certain things as long as the money keeps rolling in. So I present to you the Saracens case where they have been... for anybody that doesn't know, the situation is this. There's a wage cap in professional rugby in the UK and England that you're not meant to go over. There are apparently some loopholes, which, believe it or not, can keep you within the salary cap, which Saracens have been availing themselves of, which is creating joint venture investment vehicles with those same players and investing money into them to do who knows what for those players. Now, apparently, everybody knew about this for a long, long time, kept Stumm because Saracens was a great story and money was coming into the game, new investors, who cares about salary cap? And then all of a sudden, people say, well, actually, we've changed our mind. This is the poster child for the kind of things we said on the last podcast. It's all fine until it's not fine, and then you get into an unholy shambles of inconsistency and hypocrisy. What do you think?
I think retroactive punishments are dreadful things all around. I think if Saracens have broken the rules, then they deserve to be punished. If you change the rules on them, then that's a wholly different thing. So, you know, it's very difficult to say, you know, we've decided that this is now not fit and proper and we're going to go back because you were doing it and punish you for it, I think is wrong. I think if you leave loopholes in the rules and clubs exploit them, is it strictly the right thing to do? Possibly not. Is it morally ambiguous? Possibly so. But you, particularly with a game like this, Rog, you put a set of rules in place, you enforce them rigidly, and if someone breaks the rules, you punish them. It's that simple. If someone finds a loophole, it's up to you to close it. If they find a loophole and you get pissed because they found it, that's on you. You're the governing body. That's what you're there to do. You know, we could get into Mr. Musk and some of the things that's going on with the SEC, for example. Same thing. If there is a way around the rules and you find them, then I'm not going to say good for you, but I'm going to say if you haven't broken a rule, then it's hard to say you deserve to be punished based on that rule.
Well, the argument they would say is that they have adopted with this loophole an unfair playing field, financial doping, in a similar way to many of the clubs that used EBTs as a way to play their player wages, which were an ambiguous tool that was never clear whether they were in the black, the white, or the grey.
So make it clear. As soon as it comes to light, make it clear.
The point
it's
is,
very, very simple.
Well, in the case of EBTs or in the case of film financing, as you know, HMRC all of a sudden can say, well, it was clear until yesterday and now it's not. And one of the things that a lot of listeners won't realise is that so many people in the football industry who had taken investments in these film financing projects, Alan Shearer being one of them, ended up owing millions to the taxman. Now,
But that was retroactive again. I mean, retroactive punishment, which unfortunately things like HMRC have the ability to levy, is appalling. I mean, I can't get behind that at all.
All right, okay. So even on this one, you're Mr. Reasonable this week. Saracens are fine.
I don't know exactly what the wording of the rule is. You know, I'm going on the press coverage, which obviously is sensational because it's sensational story.
Yeah, it's not all come out yet, the report, to be fair. Right.
And so if it turns out they have broken the rules, bang to rights. If it turns out that they've been smarter than the people who make the rules, then change the rules. You know, close the loopholes, make sure they can't do it anymore, and take the public embarrassment that you allow that to happen, because you are the rule makers. That's what you're there for.
Yep. Again, another great example of how difficult it is to be in a governing body and the kind of compromise.
Well, Roger, isn't right. Here's the rules. These are the rules. Have you broken them? No. Have you got away with something? Yes. Okay. What's the new rule we have to put in place to stop anyone else getting away?
Yeah, I know. But listen, it's not as easy as that, because every sport needs fresh investment. Somebody that's willing to put in fresh investment, kind of like you do a little bit of a deal with the devil, you know. And I'm speaking from experience here.
I know you are.
And you know, it's better for the sport, it's better for everybody if fresh money comes in and teams be able to buy the best players that are currently playing in the Southern Hemisphere and we can attract them up, because guess what, he's setting up a joint venture with these players so that he can avoid the salary cap. My rules say he's probably okay legally, stinks to high hell morally, but it's fresh money coming into the sport. Tell you what, let's go out for a drink and forget about it.
Well,
that's
okay.
How it goes, mate. That's how
fine.
It goes.
No, look, absolutely fine. But that's the bit that gets to me, is that when someone gets a whiff of it, there won't be any mention of, oh, well, we did actually say let's go out for a drink and forget about it. It'll be, oh, no, we really need to haul them over the cop.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. If you decide to turn a blind eye, don't then, when it comes out, throw them under the bus. Say, you know what, we're going to work together, we're going to change the rules, we're going to make sure this can't happen.
Because
in
nobody in the governing bodies bows to public pressure when all of a sudden they get a little bit of heat. No, nobody does that.
Listen, we're uncovering everyday new reasons why you ran the Scottish League and I never could.
Well, not for very long and not very successfully, mate.
All right. Well, look, that's almost a quickfire round there, Rog. You've thrown us with the end there, although it went on for probably longer than a quickfire round, sure. But we've reached the end again,
good.
My friend.
That was good.
We have reached the end of another week. All that remains is to thank you for listening. Remind you to please rate and review the podcast, share it with your friends, follow us on Twitter. You'll find us, if you don't know already, at Entertained R. That's ARE the word. And you will find me, should you go looking for me, at TTMYGH.
And if you want to follow myself, it's RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Rog, as always, my friend.
Thanks, Grant.
Never a chore. Always a pleasure. Always see you soon.
See you soon. Take care.
Take care. Bye.